Hi, I'm Richard Lang, and today I'm talking with my friend Suvajo.
Hello, Richard, and hello, everybody watching this.
Yes. So I'd just like to talk a little bit about how you came across seeing headlessness and what it's meant to you in your life and so on. So where did it start for you in terms of the headlessness and what led up to it?
Yeah, that's thanks. How to answer the question? Well, I think there is a level first. It's important to say that I can't really say what led up to headlessness or how I started seeing. There might have been moments early in my life when this was ever more present. Mm. There is not a sense of it started at a certain time. Mm. However, if you speak in terms of what we'll consider headlessness as taught by Douglas Harding, is slightly remarkable. I was living in a very, very remote monastery on an island on the Thai border with Laos, a place with no electricity. And at a certain point, somebody, and I never knew who, cleared out his library and decided to donate his books. So there was a mixture of Thai and English books to this remote monastery where we were just two, three English-speaking monks. And among the many strange books there was, you know, even pieces from Jehovah's Witnesses or old collections of the Bible and books on insight meditation. There was a book called On Having No Head. Which I picked up, it caught me. And upon reading it, I was sold. It was wonderful. It was a breath of fresh air amid a period. This was my earliest time as a monk.
So roughly what year are we talking
about? So we are talking here in 91. Mm. So in a time when there was very much still the sense of having to get established in meditation and in disciplines, and somehow at the same time in came out of nowhere this sense of it's all right here, and somehow that has always stayed with me, although perhaps not always consciously, but even by reading the book I saw something I remember was like, oh, my goodness, it is so true. Hmm. And then, wonder of wonder, a couple of years later, I think it was in 94, perhaps 95, while I lived in the UK, I went for one of our, we have this in this tradition, the sense of going on walkabouts, where we just kind of go in trust. So we take our bowl, and we just leave the safety of the monastery and see what happens if we leave it. And in one of these walks, I had an address of somebody. I was supposed to be with another monk in around Ipswich. Mm. And the only address we had was of a certain Douglas Harding, who immediately answered back, "But of course, come, and I am having a gathering." Mm. And
so this is a 94 or something like that?
94, 95, yes. As far as I remember.
Right.
First time I met you, Richard.
Right.
And what was very important was, beside the experiments, which was absolutely phenomenal for me to try out, because of the... I dare say around the monastic convention there is that slight sense that remains of I am this endarkened person who has to do these practices, meditation or otherwise. I'm on my way to enlightenment. Mm. I am a seeker. Mm. And also, of course, every day you're reminded that you ain't, perhaps in a subtle way, certainly in my case, the forms reinforce that. The forms meaning the daily meditations where you always find, oh, my mind is still scrambled, or how come I ain't experiencing the great bliss? And somehow, just as this freshness of actually having immediate experiments, the pointing finger or the card, it allowed an openness that I hadn't allowed myself. And now, and the important point was, of course, it was not as if I discovered something new. It was if, yes, I recognize this freedom.
Familiar.
It's familiar. It's so it really is an act of familiarization. But what was very, very important was Douglas, at that moment, will point out to me, and here there is no hierarchy of seers. You can't say that Douglas sees better because he has done this longer. He had a way of where I felt really empowered, and this is it. And I think this is the key point that I find with meeting Douglas and the practice of headlessness, a unique contribution. That in a non-verbal way, in direct experiences, direct experiments, it actually hammers home the obviousness. You know, that we always already are awakened as we are. There is absolutely nothing that we need, quote unquote, doing. So emptiness is always on tap.
So it sounds as though it fits in very well with your monastic life.
Indeed it does. I think that coming back to the monastery, I had a sense of, well, this is actually the point from which I can begin to live a monastic life. Because in a way then, in a conventional reality, the life of a monk is actually set up in a way that if it's not as if, you know, you have to getting caught up in what about my mortgage or what about my retirement. You know, we all have ways in which we postpone awakening because something in us is not yet trusting. There's something that says, yes, as soon as I have done this or that, then I can be awakened. And of course, even in a monastery, that patterning continues. But it was however, the monastic setting is not to be taken so seriously. In some way, you know, it's a conventional reality being a monk. But there is a level, it's held a bit tongue-in-cheek. So I found that was also a great support in actually the lifestyle in itself allows plenty of opportunities to actually lean back and see. There was a little group of monks. I think we were four of us who had met Douglas. So we met up irregularly and did experiments together.
And how do you think it affects your relationships with people, with friends, with whoever, the face to no face seeing? Because relationships are the important area to think about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think also the question you ask is even deeper. In a way, you know, not only your relationship with people, dare I say, with that which we condemn, that which we think as the other. Whether it is my relationship even with a thought or a feeling or with other people, is it a relationship in which I set up a somebody, you know, often Douglas used to call it head to head, or is it, you know, space for that face that appears over there? Or can I actually be the space that allows any formation to arise and cease? And I'm humble. This is a continuous act where I'm learning. is an act of trust, really. If I fully allow the other to be, and of course we have to sit through, you know, our own inner. We have an agenda always, a subtle agenda with the world.
Mm.
And is it possible actually to lean back and let this be?
Mm.
So that changes profoundly my relationship with the other. I become the openness for the other.
Mm.
And with people, particularly, you know, it's in the start, perhaps, it can sound a bit like a technique, a way, you know, maybe I put up with others if I don't like them by being spaciousness. But more it actually become, I find over the years, like it's more like a heartfelt sense of being with others.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really so that to hear in the silence, to hear two voices, two people arising,
mm-hmm.
And being the space for both of them, and also the feelings that arise between the two people, in the sense of, so I recognize myself and find myself in the other or as the other.
Mm.
Do you find something similar?
Yes, two voices now in the one silence.
Yes.
Wonderful. Yeah,
isn't it marvelous?
Yes, alive.
Yes.
Unpredictable.
Yes. And a sense of kind of, I don't have, like a bit like, gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, is the world. Yeah.
Yeah. What about trusting it? What are your thoughts about, we sometimes talk about trusting who we are and so on. What are your thoughts about trust?
Yeah, that's another big subject, there is a level where perhaps the first thing that comes to heart is, oh my goodness, I have so little trust. In a way, the essence of Suvacho is built around fear or contraction or defense. So. The very act of seeing, or in this case, when I actually really see the fear, that it begins to dissolve it. It erodes it away. So seeing it's certainly in my experience here. It's the erosion, and this is a gradual work, and is not something I can apply technically. Saying, you know, oh, I really feel afraid now, oh, let me just go back to seeing. It doesn't seem to work like that at all. It seemed to really fully feel, fully noticing the anxiety or the fear. And to try, if I really am and fully stay with this quote-unquote thing as it arises, this other, then I call fear.
Mm.
And somehow, that begins to transform it, having a relationship with it. And in a way, there I begin to say trust. So trust not in enlightenment or in God, or but trust in the immediacy that it is well. Even that which is difficult is a something to be embraced. So in a way, you know, of course, with seeing in itself, it is so immediate. And then of course, it is also a level where I find it is multi-layered. Yeah. It's an endless discoveries, perhaps.
In what way multi-layered?
Multi-layered, that seeing is also hearing. Mm. Deeply sensing and deeply feeling.
Mm.
You know? We arise with all the sense doors from moment to moment. Mm.
It's where you're coming from.
It is. Yeah.
Whatever we call it.
Yeah. Another way, I don't know how relevant it is in the context of seeing, but over the years, the other really great, should we say, support in stabilizing. So one thing is, as you know, seeing it. Another is being it. That it just becomes a more relaxed and continuous sense of being. There I have found the sense of listening. And listening to what is called the sound of silence. So it is as if in the very act of relaxing now into the wider field of listening, this high pitch resonates. And that gives also another very, very clear background in which I can hear the sound of this voice, I can see you, and how it all arises and ceases upon this continuous shimmering sound as a background. Yeah. That is not quite, again, it's a bit like seeing, it's not quite localizable. Is it inside? Is it outside? Is it both? It is global. And in a way, yeah.
Your training in craniosacral therapy, how does this awareness inform your experience in that field?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Even more so. It is, so what this work of seeing is, as again I find, is it is endless discoveries. And the discovery that even through touch, by putting your hand on another person and listening and being completely open and silent, it allows something to happen in both the seer or the giver and the receiver, if you want. And I find that is marvelous, that sense of you empty, and the more you step back and empty yourself, the more you give the space for the other to come forward.
For something to unfold.
Yeah. And I think this is really the essence actually of it. That sense of if we perhaps a word there again is trust. When we step back and we allow the world to arise and cease. So often, if in Buddhist jargon, there is the sense of it sums up everything that arises ceases, and then there is a great emphasis for many people of wanting so badly to make everything go to cessation. So we become detached. We become the subtle one who is observing this dream, this slightly constructed self of a somebody who is beyond it. But actually, if we fully allow something to arise, that is what I'm really excited about these days, actually. That act of trust, that sense of curiosity, this is a complete new something. And so it's almost like it takes me a bit, I don't have any safety, it grabs me a bit in an uncertain territory. And then if I fully let this come in, and I don't know what will happen, will it ever end, what will happen to me, oh dear, I better go back to seeing, or whatever ways we have. But no, can I trust in, if I welcome it as it comes, and then the questioning is, can I then again, see it as it goes, yet another condition. So in a way, you know, it allows that flow of life.
So creative.
It is. It's another wonderful expression. Yeah. It is endlessly creative.
Yes.
And you and I are, again, we are creations in it.
Yes. Wonderful.
It is, isn't it?
And perhaps one more question here, Suvacho. What about suffering? Seeing and suffering, if you like.
Or yes.
Buddhism is hot on the end of suffering, I think.
Yes, I think it is, perhaps in the Buddhist corner on the spiritual market, particularly the doctrinal take, a way in which the word, the classical word dukkha, which means stressful, as if, you know, everything that arises and ceases, by its nature, it is changeable and it is stressful. And it's not a value judgment, it's just is. That is how this universe is. Yeah. And so recognizing it, that it is like this, that there is a sense of, oh, we don't expect it to be otherwise. I think that's the key, that the suffering comes because we expect conditions to be otherwise. So there is that level of daring to say yes to life.
Including all.
Hopefully. And then I say, you know, ooh, when you say that, ooh, touch wood. Because we all experience these moments, you know, when it is overwhelming. I think my experience has been, Richard, that actually the bare experience of being a human being in a separate form and experiencing the world through the senses, even under best conditions, it is a rather overwhelming experience. And to acknowledge also that often we are overwhelmed. So when people act out of patterns of fear and violence and self-contraction, to hold both ourselves and others with that sense of, it really comes from a place of overwhelm.
And how does what we might call the seeing, or whatever you want to call it, how does that help you cope with that kind of situation?
It doesn't. I will put it slightly different, that it has never been my experience that, quote-unquote, seeing helps me. Again, that's making a thing out of seeing. What I notice is seeing doesn't solve anything, but it dissolves the one, even just for a moment, say like now. It dissolves the one who, quote-unquote, thinks or feels that he has a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, as it is, it can be sometimes, you know, the overwhelm is so strong that a second later the somebody is back again. And then again, the very act of seeing, let go. So here it is again. So the seeing doesn't solve anything.
Mm.
I would say I prefer, my experience has been it dissolves the one who thinks that this is a problem. And emotional distress takes sometimes a little bit longer. It certainly can dissolve immediately the thinking, you know, if you find the mind is spinning around, it's gone. And yet, of course, on a kind of felt level, there can still be a reaction that sticks. And that also, so that's again, you know, so then we bring attention to that.
Mm.
Mm. And sort of, yeah. And that can be a little bit more gradual.
Wonderful. Share the two voices in the one silence.
It is. Yeah?
Coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.